This audio tape by Greg Kokel is one of the resources of Stand to Reason, an organization committed to training Christians to make a thoughtful defense of their faith and values in the public square. We hope this tape will be helpful. Now, here's Greg Kokel.
I would like to give you my best attempt here at making a defense for the full personhood and full humanity of the unborn from the point of conception. Now, I understand that much of the debate and discussion does not focus on the personhood of the child. In fact, some pro-abortion speakers and thinkers actually fully concede the full humanity and full personhood of the child and still argue in favor of abortion. I'm thinking specifically of Judith Jarvis Thompson and her 1971 treatment called The Violinist, that some of you might be familiar with, a recent book by Ellen McDonough entitled The Enemy Within, the same kind of argument. I have just recently written a response to both of those arguments in our journal, and it's entitled Unstringing the Violinist. I just wanted to draw attention to that kind of issue, the concession of the personhood and the full humanity of the unborn, and still arguing pro-abortion. There are serious flaws with the arguments there, although on the surface they sound very compelling, and I deal with those flaws in that article, Unstringing the Violinist. Today, though, I'm going to speak to one particular issue, and it's an issue that is quite confused, I guess, even among pro-lifers. The fact is that no one really talks about abortion very much. I mean, they talk about choice and privacy, they talk about back-alley abortions, they talk about teen pregnancy and rape and incest and those kinds of things, but no one talks about abortion, per se. They don't respond to the one issue that seems to trump all of these other issues. It seems to me that you can't answer any of the questions that are raised in the public square, like privacy and choice and unwanted pregnancies and coat hanger abortions and unwanted children and all of that, unless you answer a prior question. And so my goal this morning is to simplify, in one sense, this whole issue for you by setting aside these other things that turn out to be, in most cases, just rabbit trails, things that drag you off of the main issue, and help you answer the only issue that is really important to answer, which then almost automatically resolves all the other questions. And there are a couple of things that I'm going to offer you this morning that I would actually like you to commit to memory. I'd like you to know them verbatim because you'll find that they are very useful tools when you're confronted with this issue. And here's the first thing that I want you to memorize. Four words. Can I kill this? Can I kill this? Many of you are mothers, a few might be fathers. Imagine your child coming up to you. Your back is turned. The child says to you, Mommy, Daddy, can I kill this? And what is the first question that you must ask before you can answer? What is it? Now, if it's a cockroach that he just found under his bed, smash it. If it's his little brother's puppy, hold on a minute. If it's the little boy down the street that just offended your child, wait a moment. We have to have a talk. And what we learn from this is that we cannot answer the question, can I kill this? Unless we know what this is. And that is the most important question of the entire issue, which is almost never discussed. Can I kill this? An abortion takes the life of a living thing. Whether it's right or wrong to take that life depends entirely on what that living thing is. And we are going to address our comments this morning to that issue. And here's the second thing, a little longer than four words, that I'd like you to commit to memory. So I'll say it slowly so you can write it down. If the unborn is not a human being, if the unborn is not a human being, no justification for abortion is necessary. Parenthetically here, do whatever you want with it. You can have it for lunch as far as I'm concerned. If it's not a human being, none of these other issues are relevant. If the unborn is not a human being, no justification for abortion is necessary. However, if the unborn is a human being, No justification for abortion is adequate. Now, there's a very, very small caveat to that, and I'll get to that in just a moment. Some say the unborn is not a human person. Have the abortion. But if the unborn is a bona fide human person, then that changes everything. People say, well, abortion's a tough issue, and I've been on many programs, TV, radio, where this issue has come up, and they shake their head and they rub their chin and they say, abortion's a hard issue. There are no easy answers. And you know what? If I'm right about this, then it's not that hard. All we have to answer is one question. What is the unborn? And if it turns out that the unborn is a human being, then we have a moral question. The first one, by the way, is a factual question. What is it? And it can be answered without any reference to morality whatsoever. The second one is a moral question. If we determine that the unborn is in fact a human being, now our question becomes a moral one. How ought we act towards human beings who are in the way and can't defend themselves? Now, is that simple? What could be more simple than that? We answer the first question, the factual question, then we ask the moral question pertaining to that. And some might say, well, you know, you're misrepresenting. How do we act towards human beings who are in the way and can't defend themselves? And my question is, isn't that a fairly clear description of the justifications for abortion? They certainly can't defend themselves. And they are in the way. Now, that could take a couple of different shapes. They're in the way financially. They're in the way because they're an emotional drain. They're in the way because they're a reminder of a rape or incest. And so the emotional ante goes up there, I understand, but the question is still the same. How do we deal with a human being who reminds us of a rape? That's really the question. Then we can ask whether it's justified to take the life of that human being. Now, of course, when I put it that way, it's almost like the talk is over, isn't it? Because it's quite obvious that if there is a human being who reminds us of an awful circumstance, we don't kill them to take away that memory, as if killing them would take away the memory of it. I'm entirely sympathetic to people who go through those kinds of experiences. But why should the child pay for the crime of its father? Or here's another way of looking at it. If a woman is raped and they capture the rapist, can she then execute summarily the rapist? Well, the answer, of course, is no. Well, if she can't execute the rapist to ease her emotional pain, why can she execute the child? Someone's going to say, wait, but there's a difference. It's not parallel. The rapist is a human being. Ah, you see, now we know what the real issue is. The real question is not whether there's a rape or emotional trouble or turmoil. The real question is whether there's a human being involved. And that's true for just about every issue. Back alley abortions, unwanted children, financial stress, everything you could imagine can be answered by applying this question. Even the more difficult and somewhat difficult problem of a woman who has a pregnancy that threatens her life. And in this particular situation, my personal view is that abortion is allowed. And here's why. Now listen very carefully. When two people are drowning and you can only save one, you act to save one. If you don't act at all, they both die. And so when a woman's life is endangered through a pregnancy, generally, almost without exception, that child is going to die anyway if mom dies. The goal then of the abortion is not to take a life, but to save a life. You save one rather than not doing anything, not acting, which I think would be irresponsible, morally irresponsible, and as a result, you save one life even though one is lost. The intent here is not to kill, it's to save. That's an important part of a moral act here. And secondly, notice how I've reasoned. I've answered the question, given full value to the human child who is also in question. I'm not saying that the unborn is nothing, it's a piece of tissue, it's unrelated, it has less rights. I'm looking at the unborn consistently, from my point of view, as a fully valuable human being on par with the mother. And then having to make my answer. So answering this question allows us to answer a host of other questions. That's why I think it's the key to the abortion issue. The key question, what is the unborn? Now, I'm going to tell you what my position is on this. It has three simple steps. The first is that at the point of fertilization, the unborn becomes a unique individual living being. It's a separate being from its mother, even though it's domiciled inside the mother for a season. It is not the same as the mother. The second is also a factual premise, first being fertilization is the point at which the living being comes into being. The second one answers the question, what kind of being is it? The kind of being that is inside of a mother is a human being. It'll take many forms during its life, but it will always be the same thing, a human being, until it dies. The third is the moral question then, as I mentioned earlier, how do we act towards human beings that are in the way and can't defend themselves? The unborn child has a life we ought to respect because human beings are special kinds of living beings that have intrinsic value. And by the way, if I make my case, just three steps, if I can make my case, then abortion turns out to be the intentional killing of an innocent human person for reasons that do not justify taking another human being's life. I think there are justifications for taking human life. I think the so-called seamless garment argument that to be pro-life you have to be against capital punishment is deeply flawed because it doesn't take into consideration the difference between guilt and innocence. But I think that if our analysis is correct here, it's going to turn out that the reasons that are given for abortion are not adequate reasons to justify taking of another human being life. So let me start with the first issue. The unborn is a living thing. Notice, by the way, that I'm not using the word fetus, which I think is rhetorically misleading. I am also not using the child at this point because I haven't really demonstrated that. I'm trying to be fair and neutral as possible. I think this is an important thing when we make our presentations. We don't want to use loaded language that presumes our position before we've established it. That's kind of cheating a little bit. When people see that, it bugs them. When others do it, it bugs us, so we shouldn't do it as well. So I refer simply to the unborn at this point. What is the unborn? First, it's a living thing. Some people say, well, nobody knows when life begins. Well, this is just simply false. There is absolutely no grounds whatsoever for this uncertainty because the statement isn't true. In fact, there is actually no beginning of life at all. There is no period of non-life in the entire sequence of events from mating to birth. From the beginning to the end, there's an unbroken continuum of life. You have a living sperm and a living egg that join to form a living zygote. You have no period of non-life after which life suddenly springs into existence. So the question that no one knows when life begins is almost a nonsense question regarding this issue because there's never a period of non-life. There is this continuum of life. It doesn't begin at some stage of development. The unborn is alive at every stage. And the fact, by the way, that the unborn is growing biologically proves that it's alive. So we have the unborn as a living thing, no question about it. It's not only a living thing, it is a separate living being. The reason I focus in on this is because there is an objection raised in which people say, well, a woman can do whatever she wants with her own body. And sometimes I ask an honesty question at this point. People say, it's my body, I can do what I want. I said, is this really an important issue? Is this really an important point? Yes, it is. I have authority, this is the autonomy argument, I have authority over my own body. And I asked the question to get him to reinforce the significance of this kind of objection. And then I say, therefore, if I show you that it isn't your body that's in question, then that seriously undermines your point of view. If I can show you it isn't your body, then you'd have to abandon this objection, which would seriously undermine your point of view. And now they're stuck. They can't say no because that would be intellectually dishonest. And there are two quick responses. Clearly, the unborn is not the woman's body. There is a distinct life that begins at conception, and any textbook in biology can make this clear. When the individual separate life of a living being begins is at conception, because the conceptus has something different from every other cell in its mother's body. It's got its own unique chromosomal fingerprint. And eventually this living being that has its own unique chromosomal fingerprint, a combination of 23 mom and 23 dad, because of that uniqueness, this form that is very small will eventually develop to express that in its body, its morphology, its physical development. So what you're able to see later in development is actually inherent in that little bitty unborn thing, regardless of what species it happens to be, from the very moment of conception. And this is why we know that not only is the unborn a living thing, but it is a separate living thing from the mother who carries it, because it's got a different genetic fingerprint than the mother. Everything of a mother's own body bears her genetic fingerprint. That's why DNA testing of even hair and blood samples and stuff can identify the human being that goes with it. Clearly, the unborn is not part of the woman's body, and sometimes directly to the issue, I ask a very simple question. I'm, by the way, giving you the full presentation so you have the deeper understanding. Sometimes you don't, most of the time, you don't have time to spend 45 minutes to make the case. I'm giving you a couple of quick questions you can ask to get to the issue very quickly. One of them is, can I kill this? Here's another one pertaining to this being the woman's own body. I ask the woman that I'm talking to, can I ask you a personal question? They never say no, by the way. Do you have a penis? She says, no. Could your unborn child or your unborn have a penis? Yes. Then the unborn is not you, is it? Now this is not slick rhetoric. This is basic biology, and a simple question can identify it. It's not just the sexual organs. The sex of the child is what's focused on there. That can be different from the mother, but also the blood type and eventually separate brain waves and all kinds of other things. This is evidence that even though the unborn is very small, it is living and it is a separate being from the mother. And as just a little aside, when a woman says, I can do anything I want with my body, well, that's just not true. No person, male or female, can do anything they want with their body in a civilized society. I had a woman who I was in a discussion with in Seattle about a year and a half ago in an airport. We were discussing this because we were waiting for an airplane. And a cordial discussion, but she made this comment. I said, you know, when you walked out of your car and you stepped across the curb into this airport, the federal government strapped all kinds of restrictions on your body. It just isn't true. It's just false that you can do whatever you want with your own body. You can't. That's the first problem with that response. The second one is that it's not her body. It is a separate body inside of hers. Her body is involved, and I don't want to minimize that. But the welfare here is not just the welfare of her body, but the welfare of another body. And if you think about it, a year or so ago, this couple in New York, remember, they went down to Florida and left their children in the apartment to fend for themselves for 10 days? You know what argument didn't wash with the DA? It's my body. I can do what I want with it. Why? Because mothers and fathers have obligations to their own children that are not sustained with other kids. There are parental obligations that apply. And if parental obligations are sustained towards children, one's own children, then the only question that needs to be asked here is whether one has a child or not. The argument of bodily autonomy is moot. It's unrelated. It's irrelevant to the discussion. Once again, we're back to the basic issue. So, the unborn is a living thing, a separate living being with its own chromosomal genetic fingerprint. Now, the last question we have to ask is very simple. What kind of being is it? What kind of being is it? And this is remarkably simple to answer. There are some 4 billion, 5 billion, 6 billion, I don't know, people in this world. Do you know that you can locate any human being just about by identifying their address? And generally, addresses work from large to small. So in the broadest sense, you could say the address of, I'll say, Greg Kochel when he's in his stand to reason office, is the world, North America, United States, California, Hermosa Beach, Pacific Coast Highway, 2420 is the actual location. Notice how I went from general to specific. And by going from general to specific, we can identify the exact physical location of Greg Kokel's place of work. Now, the same thing could be done in the biological realm. It's called taxonomy. Every living thing of the 1.7 million different living organisms, different types of living organisms, has a biological address. And it's identified by larger categories going down to smaller ones. And if you know about the taxonomic system, the categories from larger to smaller are kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. So if you want to know where any particular living organism fits on the natural continuum, identifying what it is, you simply look at its taxonomy. And in the case of you and I, we are of the kingdom animal, the phylum Chordata, the class Mammalia, the order Primate, the family Hominid, the genus Homo, and the species Sapiens. For common parlance, we are Homo sapiens. Now, every single living thing, if it indeed is a living thing, falls somewhere on that continuum. Another way of saying it is every living thing is something. It isn't nothing that becomes something. Every living thing is something when it comes into existence as a living thing. Now, we have something in existence as a living thing. We have a separate living thing inside of a woman. Now, the question is, what kind of being is it? There is only one answer. It is a human being. It is a being. What kind of being is it? It is a human being. Now, how do I know? Well, I'll tell you a couple of ways. I mentioned that the living thing we know is separate from the mother because it's got its separate genetic fingerprint. And the idea of fingerprint is that it's unique to individuals. Well, this being has a very special genetic signature. The concept of signature is broader. When we look at the genes of the zygote, it has a human signature to its genes, 46 chromosomes that are unmistakably human. When you have a human genetic signature, that makes you a human what? Being. When you have a human signature, it makes you a human being. Now, a zygote, by the way, is not just like any other human cell. Like a skin cell from the tip of my finger here will have a human signature to it, and it will also have my genetic fingerprint to it, so to speak. It's me. It's not just a human being, but it's also Greg Kokel, the human being. But why isn't that the same as Greg Kokel, the human being? Because it's not the kind of cell that differentiates into a full human body eventually. Zygotes are. A zygote is an entirely different type of cell than any other cell. The zygote is the being which then differentiates into different kinds of individual cells. The unborn is a living, separate human being. Now, there's one other way you can prove this. I'm giving you two arguments now for the fact that the living being is a human being. One is the genetic signature. The second one is the law of biogenesis. Now, I know this sounds somewhat complex. It's actually quite simple. Is it alive? Yes. Is it separate? Yes. It's a separate living being. What kind of being is it? It's a human being. How do you know? Because it's got a human genetic structure. And sometimes I ask people, what kind of being is it? Is it a doggy being? And an acorn tree is an oak. They are all oaks. Now, an acorn seed is not an oak tree, but all we're saying is that the child isn't the adult. And you know this by asking the question, what kind of thing is an acorn? It's a seed, right? What kind of seed? It's an oak seed. So an acorn is an oak being in the seedling stage, or I should say the seed stage. An oak sapling is an oak being in the sapling stage and the mature tree and so on. And what this teaches us is that no living thing looks the same at any stage of development that it does at other stages of development. And that's not profound. This is basic, axiomatic. We all know this. We've just not been careful to apply it to this particular question. The unborn looks like a human being at that stage of development. And what this also tells us, by the way, and this will come in a few moments, you'll see how important this is that living things are not look-like kinds of things, they are be-like kinds of things. What makes a living thing what it is not what it happens to look like. Because the looks change in living things over time. And so by biology, the laws of science, and some basic common sense, we've come to the conclusion, by the way, no morality in here so far, is there? There's no conjecture in here. There's no, like, opinion. I'm trying to stick with the hard, cold facts at this point, and I think I've done so. And by doing that, we've determined that an unborn, at every stage of its development, is an individual living human being. The unborn, at every stage of its development, from the moment it comes into being, which, according to biology, is from conception, is a separate living individual human being. What I hope that we've shown is that a human being is not a look-like kind of thing. It's a be-like kind of thing that looks different at different stages. Sometimes it looks familiar, healthy, normal. Other times it looks odd, nothing like the adult. And in rare cases, the body looks all wrong, like anencephalex. If you remember baby Teresa a few years back in Florida, born without a cerebral cortex, only a brainstem. Some children are missing things. Some adults are, too. But because they're missing parts, I'm arguing, doesn't mean they cease to be what they are, human beings. If you haven't seen it yet, you owe it to yourself to rent the video, The Elephant Man, and watch it. It's a true story of John Merrick, a man who is severely misshapen from birth. He was in freak shows. He was beaten. He was whipped as an animal. Until a doctor discovered him, and first, simply out of scientific curiosity, brought him into his care, and later began to love John Merrick as a human being, which is what he was. It's a very, very touching story, and it gives a very important message that is captured in one vivid scene. As John Merrick leaves the hospital fully cloaked so people can't see his form, just to be able to get out and walk among the normal people. And some little boy happens to see his face as he looks up through the open jacket that he was wearing. And the little boy is so horrified because his body is terribly misshapen that he screams. And when the little boy screams, John Merrick swirls on his heel and he begins to run. And of course, this attracts the attention of the crowd. They see a little boy screaming and then somebody running. And of course, when he's running, his clothing is starting to come open and his form is visible and he's hideous. And some take up flight and more people scream when they see his face. And pretty soon there's a mob chasing poor John Merrick, the Elephant Man. And the mob corners him down in this subterranean stairwell of a train station. Cudgels raised, ready to beat him to death. And he looks up at them from his position, cowering in the corner of the stairwell. And he says, I am not an animal. I am a human being. And there's a moment of silence, hesitation. And one by one, his tormentors turn on their heel and they walk away. You see, John Merrick, the Elephant Man, was a human being. He didn't look like a human being. It was awful to even look at him. But he still was a human being. Why? Because a human being is not a look-like kind of thing. It is a be-like kind of thing. Now, at this point, someone's going to raise an objection. They're going to say, listen, just being human does not make you a person. Just being a human doesn't make you a person. This is the human non-person argument. All human beings aren't persons. Now, I have just one question at this point. And this is another question you should commit to memory. Three words. What's the difference? Don't try to fall into some philosophic defense of the personhood of the human being. You don't need to. They're making the claim. Some human beings are not persons. My question is, what's the difference? Now, they must be able to answer this. And here's why they must be able to answer it. They have just disqualified the life of certain human beings because they don't possess something. That thing that they don't possess is personhood. If they don't possess the personhood, even though they're human beings, they can be killed for frivolous reasons. Now, by golly, if you hold that point of view, you better be darn sure what the difference is. You know the response that I get when I ask, what's the difference? I get silence. Because these people have never thought of it before. They don't know what the difference is. Frankly, in most cases, they don't care. Because this is not a principled response, ladies and gentlemen. This is a way to get rid of you. This is a way to justify people doing just what they want to do, regardless of what the facts are. And that, I think, unfortunately, and I don't mean to be contentious here and argumentative, but my conviction is, in having many conversations with people about this issue, is that's precisely what's going on. Most people are not interested in a careful assessment. This is a careful assessment. This is straightforward, easy to follow, and is utterly conclusive. People aren't interested in that. They get out from underneath the force of this argument by saying, but it's not a person. Why do they say that? Because they heard some other pro-abortionist say this, and it silenced the opposition. You ask, what's the difference? As I've just pointed out, the human being is not a look-like kind of thing. It's a be-like kind of thing. We know what kind of being it is because of those other tests that I showed you. You know it's a human being if it's born of human parents. End of issue. Further support, it has a human genetic signature. End of issue. Now, generally, people try to disqualify the personhood of human beings in three ways. They don't look like human beings are supposed to look. They don't do what human beings are supposed to do. And the law gives a third one, implicitly. They are not located where human beings are supposed to be located. Now, let me take the last one first. These are the only three justifications for disqualifying human beings from personhood. Because it does seem that human beings just turn out to be personal kinds of beings. So why disqualify them? Well, here's one reason. They're not located in the right place. Well, what is that? Right now I'm thinking of a little child named Rachel. In fact, in a week I'm going to see her. She's about a year and a half old, though that's misleading. When Rachel was 2 months old, she was still 6 weeks away from being full term. She was born prematurely at 22 weeks in the middle of her mother's second trimester. And on the day of her birth, Rachel weighed 1 pound, 9 ounces. And a couple of days later dropped down to under a pound. She could fit in the palm of her daddy's hand. That little precious unborn human person could fit in the palm of her daddy's hand. Now, the doctors did an incredible job to save the life of this child. And this child today is one of the most beautiful little children you will ever lay your eyes on. They worked very hard to save her life. You know what's curious, though? If a doctor would have walked into that room where poor little Rachel was nursing at the breast of her mother, there late in its second trimester in terms of development, and if he would have killed that child right there, then he would be guilty of homicide. But if that same Rachel, listen, the very same Rachel, were moved over 6 inches inside the womb of her mother, that child's life could be taken, not just at that time, but all the way up to the time of birth, through legal abortion. Now, here's the question. What is the relevant difference? Why is one a person and the other not a person under the law for protection? The only difference was location. And my question is, how is it that location changes the nature of a thing? Do you cease being yourself when you move from the kitchen into the den? From the street into the supermarket? Do you cease being yourself when you simply roll over in bed? You see, location is not a relevant factor to determine the value of anything or the nature of anything. So the law implicitly disqualifies a human being from personhood by its location, which I hold is ridiculous. The second way you might disqualify a human from being a person is that it doesn't look like a human being. Now, I've talked about that a little bit, but let me add just a little bit more. Again, this is a little more philosophical, but it applies. Certain things change into something else when their parts are rearranged. If you take a soapbox racer and remove the steering wheel and the wheels, it becomes a soapbox again. You take a ruler and you scrape off the writing and it becomes a letter opener. You take a table and saw off its legs and it becomes a tray or something like that. So we learn from that physical things are identified with their parts. And so when you change the parts of a physical thing, you really have something different. But living things are not like that. Living things are the kinds of things that you can exchange parts and still have the same thing. That's why we can have skin grafts from other people. We can have heart transplants or liver transplants or kidney transplants. And in fact, if I were unfortunate enough to be in an accident, or anyone here was, in which you'd lose limbs, you would still be yourself. You wouldn't be someone else or something else. And what this teaches us is living things are not the same as their parts. There is some deeper thing that makes a living thing what it is, so that it remains itself even though it changes through time in physical parts. And so it doesn't seem to be reasonable that a human being's personhood should just be disqualified because of his looks. And the reason is, of course, because a human being isn't a look-like kind of thing. Nor is it reasonable that a human being's value should be disqualified because he doesn't do the kinds of things other persons do. I was listening to Dennis Prager, Jewish ethical talk show host from KABC. Wonderful man, good thinker. I disagree, obviously, on a number of things, but he had a conversation once with somebody on the air that I thought was stunning, and he said more than he realized that he said, because he is actually pro-choice, though he thinks most abortions are immoral. He is one of the few people that at least can give a sane justification for such a position. I think his justification is flawed, but nevertheless, at least he's thought it through. In any event, I was listening to his show one day, and a caller called in who is blind. Now, Dennis is a very sympathetic human being. He's a very gracious, kind, caring human being. And the blind man was relating how sometimes people treated him as less than a person and more of a thing because he was blind. And Dennis was stunned. And he says, how is it that if you lose your eyesight, you are any less a person? And then he added this, wouldn't you still be you? Now, Dennis didn't realize what he was saying, at least the impact of it, because if he did, he'd be pro-life. Because we could take this illustration further. We could say, what if he lost not only his eyesight, but his hearing and his speech? Wouldn't he still be himself? If I lost my capability to think at all, wouldn't I still be me? What if I was shrunk down to half my size? What if I was shrunk down to one-fifth my size, one-hundredth of my size? Wouldn't I still be me? You saw the movie, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids? Followed by, Honey, I Blew Up the Kids. Honey, I Shrunk Ourselves. And I don't know what the fourth one's going to be. They were still themselves, weren't they? Regardless of size, why does size or capability that size gives make a difference to who a person is? Wouldn't I still be me? And what this shows us, too, is that what makes a person what he is and what makes him valuable has nothing to do with his physical makeup. Not his physical parts, nor his physical capabilities. Now, J.P. Moreland, a friend of mine, a philosopher, has done some very important writing in this area, defense of the unborn. He had a conversation with his daughter, Ashley, once. She came home from school with some information about Martin Luther King's birthday. In light of that, he began to ask her some questions. He said, Ashley, do you believe that we ought to treat all human beings equally? She said, yes. He said, let me ask you a question. Do you see that picture up there on the wall? Very nice painting. She said, yes. Now, you see this little scribble here on the paper? A little picture he had drawn for his other daughter in illustrating something the night before. Just a scribble. She said, yes. He asked her, if this house were burning down, which picture would you save? And she said, the one on the wall, not the one here. And he says, yeah, you're right. And we learned something from that. We don't treat unequal things equally. Now, when it comes to human beings, you believe that we should treat human beings equally. But how are they equal? That's the question. How are human beings equal that we should treat them equally? What is the foundation, he's asking, for human rights in general and equal treatment? All human beings don't have the same looks. They don't have the physical capabilities. They don't have the same size. They don't have the same intelligence. And he went down all of these physical characteristics, and he could not find one single thing that they could identify together that was equal in terms of physical capabilities or characteristics to justify equal treatment. And it turns out that human beings are equal, but they're not equal in any way physically. What makes them equal and therefore valuable is something that's not physical. And now we begin to brush on the soul question. There is something that makes a human being a human being. a bee-like kind of thing that is completely unrelated to his physical capabilities or his physical form that gives him value, such that you cannot remove that value because the capabilities are different or the form isn't there. As long as a human being is a human being, that value obtains with regards to him or her. And therefore, we have moral obligations to any human being who is a bona fide human being. The personhood question turns out to be another moot issue. It's a rabbit trail. Why? Because all human beings are persons by nature. There is no non-person human being that later becomes a person, because if that were the case, they'd have to become a person by virtue of their body parts, which doesn't work, their capabilities, which doesn't work, or their location, which also doesn't work. And if none of those things work, then it seems to be the case that human beings are persons by virtue of the fact that they're human. It's part of the package. Now let me close with this. What is the unborn? That is the question. It's a living thing. It's a separate individual being from its conception, and the kind of being it is a human being. Further, not only are these facts undisputable on biological grounds, it seems to be the case that human beings have value in virtue of being human and not by any other thing you add on: body size, body shape, capability, or location. If humans are valuable and the unborn is human, then abortion takes the life of a valuable human being without proper justification. Now, friends, this is not a slick treatment. This is not rhetoric. This is not sloppy thinking. This is not presumption. This is not brainwashing. This is simple, straightforward science and clarity regarding a moral issue. And you can ask yourself this question, another one to memorize: were you ever an unborn child? Now, it doesn't seem to make any sense to say that you were once a sperm or you were once an egg. You weren't once those things. But does it make sense to talk about yourself before you were born? Did you turn in your mother's womb, or did you kick when startled by a noise? Many of you have mothers who can tell you of the gymnastics that you seem to do before you were born. And if you were once the unborn child your mother carried, then you must accept this undeniable truth, that killing that child through abortion would have killed you. Not a potential you, not a possible you, not a partial you, not a maybe you. Abortion would have killed you. And this is why abortion is tragic. It kills more than a human body. It kills a precious, unborn human person.
For more Stand to Reason tapes or resources, contact the store where you purchased this tape or call toll-free 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-273-2766.